Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Today is called May the 35th in China because they're not allowed to talk about it there. The 4th of June, 1989. We'll have the economic backstory to those political protests on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Today is Wednesday, the 4th of June. Good, as always, to have you with us, everybody. What happened 25 years ago today in Tiananmen Square was, of course, about the students and about democracy, but it also marked the end of the last great public debate over political rights in China. What is often ignored, though, in the historical narrative of that time are the very real economic conditions leading up to the start of the protests back in the spring of 1989. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz tells that story.
Politically, China may not have changed much from 25 years ago, but economically, it might as well be a different country. Mary Gallagher, director of the University of Michigan Center for Chinese Studies, remembers what it was like for Chinese workers in 1989.
There's this big population in the cities still working for state-owned companies, not making high wages, still having sort of an iron rice bowl. And it's creating all of these problems in the economy, and it's also reducing China's competitiveness.
And then, all of a sudden, the price of everything began to rise. University of California Irvine professor and author of China in the 21st Century, Jeffrey Wasserstrom.
While prices were going up at an average of about 7% a year in the mid-1980s, in 1988, there was a spike where it was more like 17%. And so that kind of inflation hit hard.
In a television newsreel from 1988, thousands of desperate shoppers at a Shanghai department store reach over each other to buy food. Up until then, prices were set by the government. But in 1988, the government began to systematically lift these price controls, allowing goods to be sold on the open market for the first time. Nobody knew when prices were going to rise, and that prompted waves of panic buying. A Shanghai TV reporter at the time interviewed one of the shoppers.
I've taken out all my money from the bank, and I bought a bed. I don't need one, but everyone is scrambling to buy one before the price of beds begins to rise.
Prices were rising, salaries weren't. Suddenly, many Chinese couldn't afford even simple household goods. A song by musician Sui Jian captured the feeling of helplessness of the times. I have asked you endlessly, the song goes, when will you go with me? But you always laugh at me, for I have nothing to my name. The lyrics seem to describe a boy down on his luck begging his girlfriend to leave with him. But others interpreted the boy as China's young generation, asking the rest of China, including the government, to join it. The song, Nothing to My Name, became an anthem to the demonstrations at Tiananmen Square the following year.
I think generally Americans and probably the American media and the Western media focused on the political issues more than the economic issues.
University of Michigan's Mary Gallagher says framing the Tiananmen demonstration simply as students fighting for democracy ignores the fact that the rest of China's population, many blue-collar workers, were asking for better economic opportunities, too.
I think the general support that the students got within the population was much more related to economic issues like inflation, like corruption, like failure to take advantage of opportunities. And people associated those things with political change.
But political change was too much to ask from China's leaders. A BBC report from the early morning hours of June 4, 1989, captured China's military shooting and killing unarmed civilians.
The noise of gunfire rose from all over the center of Peking. It was unremitting.
In the year following the Tiananmen massacre, GDP growth plummeted. So did foreign investment. But it didn't last long. China's government sped up economic reforms while keeping a lid on political freedoms. This is often referred to as the unspoken deal China's government made with its people after Tiananmen. We allow you to make more money. You don't challenge our authority. University of California's Jeffrey Wasserstrom says 25 years later, with China's economy now slowing down, there are signs the Chinese people want to renegotiate this deal. That's because a prosperous future is no longer guaranteed.
Now I think there's a sense that if you've been left behind, maybe you're going to be permanently left behind. And also with the rising concern about issues like food safety, just the heavily polluted air and water and all of those kinds of things, I think it's not so clear to people anymore that they can assume that their children are going to live better lives than they did.
The song that defined China's generation of 89 ends with musician Sui Jian posing a question to what many think is China's government. Why do I always have to chase you? Could it be that in front of you, I'll forever have nothing to my name? This year, China's government invited Sui Jian to sing at the New Year Gala on state television, a program watched by 700 million Chinese. Sui accepted on the condition that he only sing this song. The government wouldn't let him. Sui Jian's response to China's government, we no longer have a deal. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
You can hear the rest of that song by Sui Jian. You can see archival video of some of the panic buying by Chinese shoppers back in 1988 and a timeline of the economic events before Tiananmen at our website. It is marketplace.org. On Wall Street today, modestly up, I think you might say. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The highest profile open job in Washington right now is also quite possibly the most difficult job to do. Figuring out what's wrong with the way the Department of Veterans Affairs gets vets in to see doctors and then fixing it. One of the top hospital executives in this country, Dr. Toby Cosgrove, who runs the Cleveland Clinic, is said to be on the short list to replace Eric Shinseki, who resigned last week in the wake of that scandal. From the Health Desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
If there's one thing the VA needs to do right now, it's figure out how to make sure patients are getting the right care in the right place at the right time. That's why Dartmouth-Hitchcock CEO Jim Weinstein says Toby Cosgrove would be a great fit with the VA.
Because of his interest in patient engagement, it's probably a great choice.
On paper, Cosgrove's resume seems ideal. He's a veteran, a successful surgeon, and is seen as one of the few hospital executives in the country who's improved patient care and controlled healthcare costs. Greg Anrig with the left-leaning Century Foundation says he thinks Cosgrove could hit the ground running because the VA and the Cleveland Clinic are similar creatures.
They're team-focused, they're focused on data, they're oriented on using technology effectively.
While the patient scandal has certainly marred the VA's reputation, the VA has a sturdy track record when it comes to drug adherence rates, cost effectiveness, and even patient satisfaction in many of its facilities. One looming challenge is very high demand in areas with lots of veterans, and Cosgrove has shown he's adept at treating patients in hospitals when they need it and elsewhere when they don't. Paul Keckley is with the Navigant Center for Healthcare Research and Policy Analysis.
We're not talking about gunshot wounds anymore. We're talking about mental behaviors. We're talking about social issues.
Keckley says if Cosgrove ends up as the next secretary and is as successful in Washington as he's been in Cleveland, it could help shape hospital management around the nation. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Walmart's annual shareholders meeting, it's going in Bentonville, Arkansas at the end of the week, and some Walmart workers have been marking the occasion by holding a series of strikes across the country. Low pay is the spotlight issue, with protesters urging Walmart to raise wages to at least $25,000 a year. But as Walmart is quick to point out, only a tiny fraction of its 1.3 million workers are participating in those strikes. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark reports that in today's version of labor activism, though, the number of workers on the picket lines might be beside the point.
Cynthia Brown Elliott is a cake decorator at a Walmart in Cincinnati. She makes $8.95 an hour and lives in government-subsidized housing. When she strikes this week, she'll be holding a homemade sign that's a play on the Walmart slogan, "Save money, live better."
How can you save money if you're not making money? How can you live better if you're not getting paid better?
But that sign won't have much company from Brown Elliott's coworkers. Out of her store's couple hundred employees, just a few are walking off the job.
It's by and large not associates that are actually participating in these events. Corey Lundberg is a spokesman for Walmart. He says the relatively tiny number of workers who've chosen to strike this week shows that most workers at Walmart are happy.
Our associates are smart. They know what a good job is. That's why 1.3 million of them have chosen to work for us.
Brown Elliott, the Walmart worker who is striking, sees the low numbers on the picket line differently. She says she has lots of coworkers who've told her they want to strike, but feel like they have too much to lose. Brown Elliott is an empty nester. Meanwhile, one of her colleagues...
She's a mother, and she has children that's living in her house. She's scared of losing her job, but I only have me, you know, to worry about.
Striking didn't feel quite as risky a few decades ago, when workers were generally more skilled, when unemployment rates were lower, and when unions had more legal protections, according to Gary Chason, a professor of labor relations at Clark University. He says in today's soft labor market, strikes aren't really about employees withholding their labor.
But rather, it's a question of drawing public attention to the wages and working conditions to the degree which the employer wants to avoid the embarrassment of being seen as a poor employer.
In other words, it's about that picket sign that Cynthia Brown Elliott is holding. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It was about consumer convenience. The idea is that you drop a little file on the person's computer, and then you know them again when you see them.
I know. What could possibly go wrong? But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. The Dow Industrial is up 15 points today, about a 10%, closed at 16,737, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ up 17 points, 0.4%, ended things at 4251. The S&P 500 up 3 points, a fifth percent, closed at 1927. Prudential Financial climbed 2.4% today after the Senate approved the bill giving regulators more flexibility in how they apply capital rules to the biggest U.S. life insurance company. MetLife up 3% on that news. Coach cantered down 2.75%. The luxury handbag maker got a ratings downgrade. Also in downgrade territory, the software firm TIBCO fell 5.5% after reporting worse than expected preliminary earnings today. Bond prices were up. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.6%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee discusses developments in Ukraine. Did consumers hit the malls over Memorial Day weekend? Chain stores are scheduled to release sales figures for May. And the United Nations marks World Environment Day with the theme, Raise Your Voice, Not the Sea Level. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There were dueling congressional hearings on student loans this morning. Both the Senate Banking and the Senate Budget Committee spent some time looking into what $1 trillion in outstanding student loan debt might mean for the American economy. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren of the Banking Committee has proposed a bill that would let students refinance their federal student loans, which got us to thinking, wait, why can't you refi a student loan anyway? And what might happen if you could? Sally Herships has the story.
You can refinance payments for a house, a car, even a boat. So why can you not negotiate a better deal for your federal student loans and get out from under all that debt?
Well, you actually could.
Mark Kantrowitz is a financial aid expert. He says you could borrow from a private bank to pay off your government loan, but...
The problem is that there aren't lenders who are willing to beat the low rates on a federal education loan.
3.86 for a federal Stafford loan, if you got it today. But lots of borrowers have older loans with much higher rates, and loaning money to students can be risky. 1 in 7 students defaults.
An education lender can't repossess your education.
If Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren has her way, students would be able to refinance their federal debt with a lower rate from the government. That could make a big difference for students and grads.
Refinancing would not make the underlying debt that a person owes go away.
David Bergeron is with the Center for American Progress. But he says lower interest payments could free up an average of $2,000 a year per borrower. And if that money is spent on consumer goods or used towards a down payment for a house, it could help spur the economy, rather than going straight to the government. The government stands to make almost $70 billion from the interest on loans issued between 2007 and 2012.
The government will still make money. It just won't make as much money.
Bergeron says the long-term solution is to reduce the amount of debt and the cost of college. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
The Beige Book landed today. That's the Federal Reserve's 8 times a year look at the American economy broken down by region. The full title is Summary of Commentary on Current Economic Conditions, which is about as boring as it sounds. Far more interesting, though, is the history of how the Beige Book came to be. Binyamin Applebaum covers the Fed for the New York Times. Binya, it's good to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
The Fed starts creating this book in 1970, you write this morning. Why?
Because the head of the Fed was bored. He basically was tired of listening to the regional reserve presidents show up at meetings and read long prepared speeches about how things were going in California and Kansas City and Chicago. And he basically said, enough. I don't want to read this stuff anymore. I want you all to submit it before the meeting. We'll make a nice fancy book. We'll distribute it. Anyone who's interested can read it.
And did they wind up talking less, the regional Fed chairs?
They did, at least as long as he was in charge.
Fair enough. Paul Volcker comes along and then in 1983 starts to publish this thing, release it to everybody. Remind us what's going on that Paul Volcker wants to get this thing out there.
Well, Volcker has a problem. He's engaged in this big war on inflation, trying to drive inflation down. It's making people unhappy. Unemployment is high. The economy is not doing that well. Congress is breathing down his neck. And they want more information about what he's doing. They want him to explain what's going on inside the Fed. And he does not want to do that. So he comes up with an idea. He says, hey, we'll give you this book we've been publishing for 13 years at that point. You can have it. Maybe you'll like to read it. No one around here reads it, but, you know, it's all yours.
How is it generally received amongst Fed watchers then?
Well, the amazing thing is how much attention gets paid to it. You know, no one likes a vacuum, and Fed watchers in particular are stuck with table scraps much of the time. The Fed is still a pretty secretive place. So anything that comes out of that institution gets parsed and scrutinized. Billions and tens of billions of dollars are riding on the movement of markets. And so this thing gets a lot of attention. People count the number of words in it. They count the number of times it says weather or, you know, economy or cars or houses. They're desperate to find meaning somewhere inside the Beige Book.
And yet, no less a person than Alan Blinder, a former vice chairman of the Fed and a distinguished economist at Princeton, has said in the past, you could read all this stuff or you can ask your uncle how the economy's doing.
Yeah, there's no there. This is not a good way to get a handle on the economy.
Is the beigeness of the cover an accident? I mean, it used to be red, right?
Yeah, it's not an accident at all. The Fed actually gave it a beige cover to make the point that it was pretty boring. And, you know, there was a discussion inside the Fed shortly after they released this. They were so pleased with the success of it, and Congress came back to them, and it wanted more of their books. They have this blue book and at the time and a green book that had serious stuff in it. And there was a discussion inside the Fed about changing the covers of those books to beige as well to get Congress off their case.
Is there no merit, though, just to sort of a closer examination of the U.S. economy by region?
Listen, there's no question that we ought to be looking at. This is a huge country. There's regional variation. It's important to be understanding those patterns. But it's a question of how you go about it. And it's not even the case that looking at anecdotes is necessarily a bad idea. Listen, that's what you and I do for a living. Mm-hmm. Far be it from me to sit here and, you know, condemn anecdotes to the dustbin. But the problem is that you've got to be careful when you work with anecdotes. And, you know, what happens with the Beige Book is it's this big pile of stories, and it gets used to support whatever case people want to make. And, you know, we saw in the run-up to the crisis in 2008 a number of regional presidents cherry-picking happy anecdotes from their districts and basically saying, hey, looks like things are okay in Dallas, looks like things are okay in, you know, my part of the country, and therefore we don't need to worry about, you know, this impending crisis. So you just got to be careful when you play with anecdotes. You got to make sure that there's data underneath. And the Beige Book, you know, it's fine for what it is. Just don't take it too seriously.
Binyamin Applebaum is a Washington correspondent at the New York Times. Binya, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
We're taking Marketplace on the road this year, going across the country, doing a live and in-person stage show, unpacking the mysteries of the numbers that are at the heart of business and economic journalism today. We call it How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Numbers.
You see them every
what
day.
Is GDP?
Gosh, I don't know.
So inflation, what is it?
What does credit mean to you?
And I'll tell you what, it's not just nameless, faceless economic statistics that we're talking about here. You are a number two. Everything you do online turns into data that companies use to sort out who you are and how to make money off you. One of the big ways they do that is by things that are innocuously called cookies, little bits of data planted on our computers to track what we do. Yes, it sounds sinister now, but the idea, at least back in the beginning, was a bit more benign, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith explains.
I'm at work, and I'm taking a little web surfing break. I check out vacation rentals on Airbnb.
Oh, yes.
I look at my Netflix queue.
Is Orange Is the New Black
story? I glance over a New York Times article.
Oh, Beyonce.
Then I go to Marketplace's website.
Pure genius.
That five-minute break was a very lucrative one for data brokers. 53 companies are now tracking me just from those four sites, most of them using cookies.
The cookie was invented shortly after HTML itself was invented in the early to mid-1990s.
Aram Sinreich is the author of The Piracy Crusade. He says the cookie wasn't always the sinister character it is today. It was created because websites needed to tell advertisers how many visitors they got. And they needed a way to tell the difference between 10 different people visiting their website and one person visiting their site 10 times.
The easiest way to accomplish this without getting internet users themselves to install a bunch of clunky software was to just drop a little piece of code without their knowledge or consent onto their computers so that the next time they visited, you'd be able to read that code and recognize that they were the same person.
Then websites started using cookies to interact more seamlessly with consumers, says Ryan Kahlo. He teaches internet and privacy law at the University of Washington.
So it was about consumer convenience. The idea is that you drop a little file on the person's computer, and then you know them again when you see them.
You have cookies to thank for being auto-logged onto your email, having Amazon remember what items you put in your cart last week, and for having Google remember that you like the mountain landscape background. Cookies made the internet faster, more convenient, and more personal. Consumers and cookies had a sweet, uncomplicated relationship.
I think the turning point of all this is when ad networks really started to take off.
Gabriel Weinberg is the founder of non-tracking search engine DuckDuckGo.
And what the ad networks realized is they could drop a cookie and then track you across many different sites and, in essence, build a profile about your browsing habits.
The once sweet and humble cookie became the linchpin of the $16 billion data mining industry. Those little innocent files that were making the internet easier to use started spying on us. But maybe not for long. Aram Sinreich says for the most part, cookies don't work on mobile devices. And now companies like Facebook and Google have found a way to replace the cookie.
If you've ever been to a website and it says log in with your username and password or log in with Facebook, you've seen that technology in action.
If you log in the regular way, you're in cookie land. But if you log in with Facebook or Twitter or Google, those companies get all of your web surfing information. Sinreich says that technology will likely put a handful of companies in control of most of our data.
That puts Facebook in a really, really powerful position to kind of pick up where the cookie left off.
So the cookie's life as the internet's tracker of choice is crumbling, but that doesn't mean the cookie is going away, says Ryan Kahlo.
We will see tracking move to other fields, and basically that what will be left will be the kinds of uses of cookies for which they were originally developed.
Like remembering what was in your Amazon shopping cart, logging you onto your email, or remembering that mountain landscape background you like your Google to have. And consumers' relationship with the cookie can become uncomplicated once again.
Back to the original cookie, like your grandmother used to make.
More or less. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Our live show tour dates for the rest of the year are on our website. And while you're there, help me out and give me your thoughts on whether we ought to change the way that we do the numbers on the radio every day. It is marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today brought to you by the letter L, standing for, among other things, loser and lame. Also in Roman numerals, the number 50, which, as it happens, is the version of the Super Bowl that will be played in February of 2016. The NFL, however, knowing a branding problem when it sees it, has decreed that that year's game will break with the long-standing tradition of using Roman numerals to identify the sequence. It will be simply Super Bowl 50, not Super Bowl L. The logo, by the way, for Super Bowl 50 took them LXXIII tries to get right. Sit down. Think about that for a minute. Figure it out. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 15 points, about a 10th percent. The NASDAQ up 17 points, 4/10 percent. The S&P 500 gained 3 points. That is, as I said earlier, a fifth of 1%. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.